It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we premiere The Key 3, our new project. I'm going to be taking you into the kitchens of the most interesting cooks I know. Now, we're going to learn what they feel are their three most essential recipes, and they're going to show us how to pull them off. Now, aside from this being a collection of great cooking classes for us, their choices are pretty revealing. Take this week's guest, Thai genius, and I don't say that lightly, Andy Ricker. His key three are not what you'd expect. So stay with us for your calls and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, we're starting out with our series, The Key 3, Conversations with Good Cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. It's a fun project to put together and interestingly revealing about the cook. Take this week's guest, Andy Ricker. He fell for the street food of northern Thailand in his backpacking days. He learned the language, made contacts with Thai cooks, and started to bring back ingredients. He opened a street stand at his house in Portland, Oregon, and he called it Pok Pok. And as they say, the rest is history. Whiskey Soda Lounge followed, and now two Pok Poks in New York City. Well, we met up with Andy in the kitchen of Whiskey Soda Lounge as he was putting a steamer pot on the stove.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3.
Andy, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
So what are your key three recipes?
My key three recipes are jasmine rice, boiled egg, and steamed fish.
Why jasmine rice, boiled egg, and steamed fish? Why those three?
Because jasmine rice is the, or rice in general, is the basis of all Thai cuisine. Thai food is almost always eaten with rice, and it's more important than any other aspect of the Thai cuisine.
A boiled egg.
Well, to me, the egg is kind of the perfect food. You don't have to really do much to it, and it's very versatile. You can make it into lots of different shapes and textures, and to me, a perfectly boiled egg is beautiful for breakfast or in a soup on top of rice as a snack anytime.
Okay. Yeah. And then steamed fish. We don't steam fish in this country.
We don't seem to steam food very much. And it's one of the great techniques of cooking. And in Asian cuisines, steaming is very, very important. And probably as popular or as common as frying or baking. So if you visit a typical home kitchen in Southeast Asia, what you typically would find is you don't have a lot of appliances. You might just have a single charcoal burner or a single gas burner.
Uh-huh.
And so in order to prepare a meal, you're either cooking one thing at a time and sort of setting it aside and then cooking the next thing. With steaming, you can have layers of steamers. You can cook a whole meal on one stove at one time. So you could have your fish in there, and then maybe above that you might have
another tray, right?
And maybe you might have something wrapped in banana leaves above that, and you can steam it all at once. And then you have a complete meal.
That's right, because you buy steamers, and they have pans that sit on top of pans on top of pans. So you've got one source of heat, and you make an entire meal.
Sure.
Yeah. Show me how you steam a fish.
Okay. So the first thing we do is we make sure we've got a nice hot steamer going.
Okay.
Typically, we use a Chinese-style round steamer, but you could use any kind of steamer you want.
You have a steamer, by the way, on a burner
exactly,
the size
yes.
of a baseball field. We're in the restaurant kitchen here. Okay, but we could be using a pot with just a rack in it.
Exactly,
right,
yeah.
Over the burner. All right.
So what I like to do is first just clean the fish.
You've got a fish here, a whole fish.
It's already gutted, actually, for our
Yeah. So,
pleasure
okay.
here.
But this is, it's got the head on, the tail on, and everything
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Okay. And basically all we do is just score the fish in about 1-inch length, you know, sort of intervals down the whole side of the fish, right down to the bone.
Okay. So you're just taking a cleaver and you're making cuts down the side of the fish, but the fish is still whole.
The fish is still
and
whole.
And it looks gorgeous, by the way.
Yeah. And this is a this is a red tilapia.
But it could be any whole fish.
It could be any whole fish. Trout or sea bass or... any kind of nice firm-fleshed fish works best. If you get a fish that's too soft, like a mackerel or something, like, it doesn't steam up that well.
Yeah, and when you try to get it out, it gets it falls apart and you feel very depressed.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now what are we going to do with this whole fish?
So now we're putting it on a large plate that it's going to go into the steamer on, and we're going to add some flavoring elements into it. I'm kind of winging this one. This is going to be kind of a Thai Chinese style tasting thing. So you can pretty much be pretty free with your different ingredients, and it's pretty simple. So anyway, we're going to start with a little bit of garlic and chili. I'm just going to kind of rub that onto the fish a little bit.
What could be bad?
And we've also got some ginger and green onions.
So you're just sprinkling that over the
top?
Yeah,
just sprinkling it right over the top.
And you smeared the garlic and chili over the fish?
Yeah, and you could just put slices of garlic in there. It'd be fine, too. And then also we're going to add a little bit of sugar to sweeten up the broth because the soy sauce that we're about to add is quite salty.
Okay.
And then we're just going to add a little bit of soy sauce. And then finally, you've got a little bit of white pepper. This is the Thai version, so it's kind of a mild white pepper. It's not as strong as the stuff we get here.
Uh-huh.
A fair amount of it goes on there for good flavor. And then to this, we might add a little bit of pork stock. Makes it taste really kind of full, adds a little umami to it.
Right.
Or you can just use the water that's going to come from the steaming. You don't necessarily have to do a whole fish, though I believe that using the whole fish adds a lot of flavor because you've got the skin, you've got the fat from the head, and the bones in there. I think any kind of meat or fish or poultry on the bone just has a deeper, more complex and delicious flavor. So,
it also looks beautiful.
It does, yeah. Okay, so we're just going to... There's not much technique to this. We're just boiling water and steam, and we just drop the fish in there.
There it is.
Set it and forget it.
So how long do you figure it needs to cook? How do you figure that?
I'm going to set a timer for about 10 minutes. We've got about a pound and a half fish in there. It's we've scored it,
right, which
allows the steam to enter a little more easily.
Uh-huh.
So I'm, you know, just from experience, it's about 10 to 12 minutes. So we'll check it at 10 minutes. If it's not all the way done, we'll add a couple more minutes.
Okay.
So let's just kind of take a peek at the fish here.
Oh,
I'm
going to
mix all the aromatics into the sauce.
Yeah.
And
just
first,
scrape it off the top, right?
Just taste the sauce a little bit.
Oh, that... Well, I'm not going to be able to speak for a few moments, but... that sauce is delicious. Now, I've heard Thai food is some of the hottest food in the world, and this is very hot, but the sauce has that sweet, salty, complicated... deliciousness. The meat looks incredible.
So yeah, it's very, very tender and juicy. And again, this might be a little spicy, but I'm gonna give you a little bite here.
Thank you. I thought you'd never ask. Oh, the meat is like it's just melting in my mouth, and it's so delicate. Do you know, this is the thing that I think is remarkable about this food. You have this intense spice, and you have a very delicate fish, and yet for some reason it works together. It does not kill the taste of the fish.
Right.
And I don't understand really why it works that way.
Well, the steaming technique, you're not stepping on the flavor of the fish by frying it, so you're not adding that element of oil flavor and fry flavor. So you just got the pure flavor of the fish itself. It's also combined with the sauce, so it's all kind of enhancing... the different flavors, and it mixes together.
The thing about this is, really, I could put this fish on a plate, have those seasonings on the fish, and have this in a steamer in probably easily just 10 minutes, and 10 minutes later I could be sitting down and eating it with a family.
As long as you started the rice before you started the fish.
That's a good point, yes. Okay. Hey, Andy, thank you.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad you were able to come in today.
Now we're going to eat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thai food expert Andy Ricker created the original Pak Pak restaurant in Portland, Oregon, and now two Pak Paks in New York. Now, to get Andy's recipe for simple Thai steamed fish and to hear the rest of our conversation about the other two of his key three dishes, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern are in the realm of if they did not exist, we would have had to invent them. Their beat covers the hot dog joints, the clam shacks, and the places where the great cheap steak and the best band for the two-step are still alive and well. Their site is roadfood.com, and their weekly stopover is here. Jane, Michael, good to have you back, guys.
Hi, Len.
Hey, Len.
So what's on the agenda this week?
Well, we're going to take you to Sylvan Park in Nashville, which is one of our favorite meet and three places. Now, I know we've used that term before. Do you remember what it means?
Well, yeah. It's from the South, and it's the idea that you get a plate, and it's a meat, and it's three other things. And it's usually – I think it's usually three starches, if I recall, right?
Well, it can be vegetables.
Jell-O.
Or Jell-O, right.
Yeah, which is one of the four basic food groups, as I recall.
It can be collard greens or braised cabbage or fried
okra. But
it's
lunch.
And that's, that is the thing that originally just confounded me and pleased me no end about the South is how it is truly the only remaining part of America that has a hot lunch. It has like a sit-down hot lunch. The Southerners are not sandwich grabbers. They're not eat-on-the-run people the way New Yorkers are. They're not food truck people. They sit down like civilized ladies and gentlemen, and they order a piece of ham, a piece of fried chicken, an oxtail, whatever the meat of the day is, and their three favorite sides with a little cornbread and a little yeast roll and a glass of sweet tea. And Sylvan Park probably has one of the best meat and three menus in the world.
Now, where is Sylvan Park?
Sylvan Park is out on Murphy Road in Nashville. Actually, there's a second Sylvan Park, which has the same menu, but somehow I have to tell you, the charm of the original on Murphy Road is not duplicable, because if you go to the original Sylvan Park on Murphy Road, you'll look at it from the outside. It is a charmless cinder block building. You walk inside, the room tone is the hum of an air conditioner and the spinning of fans and the clatter from the kitchen. Absolutely plain and simple, with down-home waitresses and this meat and three menu on which the three part is so good that many people, including us, often forgo the meat part and just get simply a four vegetable plate. Because you got to have the stewed apples and you have to have the turnip greens. And of course, one of the great southern vegetables, macaroni and cheese, is never better than there. Cabbage. Now, cabbage is a vegetable that I would rarely think to order in any restaurant unless I'm in a southern restaurant where they know how to make braised cabbage with enough pig meat so that it becomes just one of the most flavorful vegetables there is.
I like the tangy cornbread muffins, and if you order white beans with them, you crumble the cornbread and you put these delicious white beans that have been cooked with pork hocks on them. Everything there is just the best,
including
I know we're going to say the same thing.
You cannot talk about Sylvan Park without mentioning its pies. I mean, this is one of those places where the pies that come from this kitchen are as homey as can be, meaning they're not beautiful, not cover magazine
beautiful. Oh, I think they're beautiful.
Well, they're falling apart, and sometimes
but that's why
the crust
beautiful.
Is so fragile that it might break when they take it out of the pie pan. But the chocolate, butterscotch, simple egg custard pie, the sweet potato pie are all wonderful. The only reason you wouldn't want to get a slice or two of pie at Sylvan Park is that their banana pudding is one of the best in the South.
Okay, we're sold. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye. Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, you can find information on their picks at splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with one chef's idiosyncratic take on the knife I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. British chef Allegra McEvedy's approach to life and food seems to be that she's primed for the next adventure. And her latest book proves this out. It's really a scrapbook of a restless, curious cook who's roamed every continent, collecting dishes, stories, and most especially knives. They carry her into lives and places. She's called the book Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen: Recipes and Knives from a Traveling Chef. Allegra, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Brilliant to talk to you, Lynn.
So you love to roam. Where did this come from?
Well, I think it started with my father, who was an historian, and he took us all over the world when we were growing up. And family holidays to me were all about sort of clambering over ruins in the Middle East and looking at cathedrals and all these sorts of amazing cultural things from when I was a tiny, tiny girl. And I just thought that's what holidays were. And I think, although I did go on strike once or twice as a teenager, I think it instilled something in me about, you know, when we do have time off from our work, it's nice to go and learn and absorb some cultures as opposed to just lying on a beach and getting a tan.
All right, but the theme of this book is built around your collecting knives all over the world. But the knives, I mean, your knives are not everyday knives. It's not like you're out there finding another paring knife or another chef's knife. Why don't you talk about some of your favorites? When I say pick a knife, which one first comes to mind?
Oh, no, you're right. I mean, I am obsessed with my knives, and they all have to have character and soul and a little bit of something special from the country that I got them in. So I think probably there's two that come to mind straight away. One is my Malawian tea-tending knife, which is a thing of incredible beauty and character. It's got a straight shaft of about kind of 15 inches and then a curve around the end, a full 180-degree curve, which is a beautiful as well, it's used for taking the very top leaves off a tea plant.
Yeah, I think to describe it, it almost looks like the knife has a wooden handle, a rectangular wooden handle, and it looks like a long J. The blade is a long J with a point.
You're obviously
at the
better
end
at this radio business than me. That's a very good.
You're
way
used
of
to doing
it.
Television, aren't you? I can tell. I can tell.
Well, you know, well, I'm actually holding the knife as we speak, so it's easy. It's just I'm sort of looking at it and trying to put it in words. But you've done it very elegantly. But anyway, so I got that in a Malawian tea plantation. This guy just knew I was admiring it, and he left it for me outside my bedroom door the next morning when we were flying off. So it was also a very kind thing to do because Malawi is incredibly poor country, and this guy who was one of the farmers on this cooperative did something so generous by giving me his knife that I would never dare to ask for. And then the other one that jumps to mind is my unagi saki, as I call it, which is a Japanese knife without a wooden handle. Look, you do the words. You're much better at it than I am.
Well, I'm looking at it in the book, and this knife is a flat piece of metal. It's a long rectangular piece of metal with an angled end that's the blade, I guess. And you know what it looks like? It looks like a box cutter that they didn't put a handle on. What is this thing for?
Well, it's for doing a very specific filleting job with an eel. You know how specific the Japanese are. It's one thing for a certain job and another for another, and it has to be just so. Well, and this was doing a very specific thing to an eel that I kind of understood, but my Japanese isn't brilliant, but we kind of worked it out between us, me and the guy in the knife shop. And it came from this amazing knife shop in Kyoto that's been making knives for the emperor's family and kitchens for over 500 years. So it's steeped in history, this shop, and just round. I was like a kid in the toy shop. You can imagine I was a bit sweaty and overexcited in there. but I came away with this one because I've never, ever seen a knife like it. You know, it's got no rivets, no handle. It's just one piece of steel. And it's just beautiful and so sharp. It's very elegant, very brutal, and very effective.
What was the hardest knife to get?
Probably my Hong Kong chopper, I would have to say. I mean, I traveled around China and Hong Kong for about 3.5 weeks, and I kept looking at knives. And I didn't see anything that I really couldn't have got back in London. And then on the last day, we were in the big market, the food market in Kowloon, and there's one floor for veg, fruit and veg, one floor for meat, and one floor for fish. And on the meat floor, the butcher's floor, there's about probably 100 stalls, but all of these guys were using the same knife. It came in three different sizes, but there was exactly the same knife. And so I was trying to say to them that I'm a chef and I've been taught the word for chef. I think it's like sushi or something. And offering some money and trying to get the knives. And they all just laughed at me and pointed. And I was sort of, you know, not getting anywhere. And then I went back to the hotel and we were literally flying out the next morning. And I just said to the guy in the kitchen, I said, can you possibly tell us we can get these? Because everyone's got them. They must be available somewhere. And he told me the street. And it was literally monsooning down outside, Lynn. And we just fought our way through the monsoon and this long street that seemed to go on forever. And am I painting a good picture for you?
Went
on forever and ever and ever. And we were fighting against the driving rain. And it was just. And then just as I was about to give up, I saw this one shot with enormous steamer baskets hanging out outside it. I was just like, if that's not it, we're going home. And I went inside and I showed her a picture that I'd taken on my phone of this knife. And she went back. And she pulled one out, and she said, last one. And it was the daddy of the collection. It was the biggest of the three. And it's enormous. I don't know how I got it back through customs, but I love it so much, and it's very, very impressive.
Allegra, thank you. A whole new world of knives to consider. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Lynn. Thanks for taking the time to talk about me and my knives.
Allegra McEvity is author of Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen, Recipes and Knives from a Traveling Chef. Now, in honor of Allegra's much-treasured Malawi tea knife, try her recipe for Malawi ginger and garlic fried fish. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. If you're not into mustards, you've missed the memo. I mean, the hot dog pairing thing is not the end of the story. Anything a salsa can do, a mustard can do, and maybe even better. The only hitch is, fine mustards are expensive. And this brings me to Noelle Carter, who did a homemade mustard piece for her Daily Dish column in the LA Times. Noelle, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
Okay, making mustard. Where did you get the idea?
You know, it's funny. I've written a number of stories for the LA Times, and you know, you think you know how to make everything, but mustard was something I never thought to make. And I guess until recently, I just never thought it was something you'd make at home. And when I started doing a little research, I realized how actually embarrassingly easy it is to make, and there is nothing like the flavor of homemade mustard.
So where do you begin to make mustard?
You know, it's really very simple. All you do is you combine mustard seeds with a liquid. That's a basic mustard. You can start with powdered mustard or whole mustard seeds, which you can get in a grocery store or online. Combine it with a liquid. Basically, the sky's the limit. And then flavor it however you desire, and voila, you've got your own mustard.
Now, I've tried this. I've had some success, but I've tried this. Mustard seeds are famous for being difficult to grind.
They can be. And, you know, I looked up a bunch of different recipes while I was researching the story, and the easiest way to do it is soak the seeds first and then grind. And you can grind them in a food processor, and it's so much easier. If you like the workout, you know, go ahead and grind the dry seeds. But me, I like it a little easier.
Well, I want to backstep a second, because I know there are different kinds of mustard seeds, and each one has a different sort of flavor. So can you just walk us through the mustard seed choices and how we can work with them?
There are three types of mustard seeds that you use to make your own mustard. You've got your black mustard seeds, which are the smallest seeds, and they basically contain the most heat, the most pungency. There's a slightly larger brown seed, which is much easier to find, and that the heat's a little bit less pungent. And then you've got your white or your yellow mustard seeds. They're kind of an off-white, yellowish color, and those are typically the most mild of the mustard seeds.
Okay, and those are the ballpark mustard seeds.
That's correct.
Right.
And you just stick the seeds in a bowl, cover them with liquid. Usually you use like a cold water or a cold vinegar. And then, you know, wait until they're softened and then go ahead and grind them up and finish your mustard from there.
All right. But now, does it make a difference what kind of liquid you use?
It does. And another thing, the temperature of the liquid makes a big difference, too. I found, I read a few different sources said that water tends to produce the most heat. There's an enzyme that works with the mustard to release the heat, and water seems to be the most complementary environment for that enzyme to get going. You get the best heat, and I found it produces the cleanest mustard flavor with the best pungency. You can also use a vinegar or a wine, even a beer, to hydrate the mustards. Those will all allow the mustard to release its heat, but you don't. I found that you don't seem to get as much heat if you hydrate the mustard in a liquid other than water.
Uh-huh. Now, you do see mustards that have wine or beer. Can you add some of that later on?
Definitely, definitely. Hydrate your seeds, flavor them, grind them. Take a taste of the mustard. Now, you know it'll evolve as the mustard sits, but after you've hydrated the mustard and you've ground it up, go ahead and add other liquids. Add a little vinegar, add a little beer, sweeten it and spice it to your taste, and then, you know, just keep tasting it as the mustard ages, adding a little bit here, adding a little bit there to develop it as it goes.
And then you can add all kinds of flavorings, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. The sky's the limit. Brown sugar, maple syrup. I tried a mustard. It was a honey-based mustard with chopped fresh herbs, and it was so nice with turkey after the holidays. But really anything, even chopped fruit. I tried a mustard with I rehydrated it in hard cider, and then I added chopped fresh apples. And the fresh apples just, they added such a nice sweetness and a crunch factor to the mustard. It was really different and something that you don't see in the stores when you buy mustards.
That sounds fabulous. How long will it keep?
You know, it depends. Mustard's known for having it's got these antibacterial properties, and I've read that, you know, mustard will keep basically forever. But if you're going to be adding other ingredients, I would definitely, you know, store it in the fridge after it's ripened and developed. And I would keep mine probably no more than 2 to 4 weeks, depending on what you add to it.
This is great. Noelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Noelle Carter writes the Daily Dish column in the LA Times.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
Okay, we're ready to talk to you. Anything goes. 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email at splendidtable.org. Friend us on Facebook. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Susan calling from Vermont. Susan, hi.
Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
Chorizo, Spanish sausage.
Right, right.
My parents, my mom was from Spain, and her father used to make chorizo when I was a kid. It would hang in the back room, which wasn't heated in the wintertime. It was a cured sausage. It was wonderful. We just got back from a trip to Spain and Portugal, where I relived it. And I want it in my life again. So I've tried to buy it over the years here, and nothing compares to what I had over there. So I'm committed to making it. But I don't know where to find a good recipe to start.
Well, you know, I think, you know, there are a couple of books that I think would be really good places to begin.
Okay.
First of all, anything by Penelope Casas.
Okay.
Yeah, she literally wrote the books on Spanish food.
Oh, great.
Yeah, she's done a series of books. She is from Spain. Sort of, you know, authenticity is kind of her middle name.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I think you would find very good material there. Now,
okay.
Now, the other person, and I have to say I adore him because he's an amazing man.
Uh-huh.
He's a chef in Washington, D.C. He does a series on PBS called Made in Spain, and it's Jose Andres. And if you ever see him in action, you will fall in love with him.
I'm going on and on, but
he's truly one of those good souls in the world. But
yeah,
I think if you look online and you look at any of his books, he would probably have some very good material on how to make it. There's a site called La Tienda, and it is mainly about equipment and foods imported from Spain.
Right.
And they may carry it, but I just wonder if they may not be able to lead you to some very good recipes. I would look up, I can't remember the name offhand of the people who actually run it. It's a family.
Oh, cool.
And I met them at one point, and they were really delightful. And I just wonder if you let them know, you know, your heritage and your background, you share this in common with them, and that, you know, you remember the taste of this, and you really want to make it yourself. Could they help you out? You just might make a connection there, and they may be able to help you out with it.
That sounds wonderful. I have one other question about it, and I remember as a girl my grandfather being very insistent that he needed Spanish paprika and not Hungarian paprika.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. They're two different animals. But the point is that there is a different taste from country to country, from one part of a country to another, in terms of the ground chilies, the paprika. I've tried to get a real handle on this, and I must say I haven't spent half the amount of time in Spain that I would like to. That would, by the way, read that as, I have not spent the 10 years I would like to spend. No, I mean, you know, every country has this, but Spain profoundly so, that, you know, you dip your toe in and you realize, you know nothing.
No, the food is just so diverse and wonderful.
Oh, yeah. But try, those are good places to begin. They're going to lead you down a fascinating garden path.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. I'm looking forward to experimenting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, well, thanks so much, Lynn.
You are
welcome. Great talking to you.
You're welcome. Take care. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We're going to be back to your calls in a moment, but first, the weekly trivia challenge is up. Now, the question is, what role did sesame seeds play on burger buns in South Africa recently? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what was the role of sesame seeds on burger buns in South Africa recently? Well, the seeds spoke to the blind. The Wimpy fast food chain used sesame seeds to spell out messages in Braille on the buns. For instance, 100% pure beef burger made for you. Now, from what we can learn, they did only 15 buns. They were for a YouTube video to advertise their new Braille menus. It's a strange way to reach a blind audience, don't you think? Okay, back to your calls. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Tara's on the line from Minneapolis. Tara?
Hi.
Hi. What do you want to talk about?
Well, my boyfriend has a passion for spaghetti and meatballs, and he's a pilot. Wherever he has layovers, he's in search for the best meatballs with sauce. He's really important to me. He's my other half. Handsome, funny, giving, just a real exceptional individual. And I'm hoping to serve him in an unforgettable plate of spaghetti with meatballs, along with a marriage proposal from me.
Oh, you're going to make me cry. That's lovely.
Yeah.
That's lovely. So you want a recipe?
I want a recipe, and I've never made meatballs in my life, and I'm afraid they're going to fall apart.
Okay. Here's the thing about meatballs, all right? One of the great lines I heard about meatballs, it was from Mario Batali, and it was, the mistake we make with meatballs is we think they're all about meat. and they're really not. My favorite recipes run something like this, okay? Yeah. You might take, I'm going to start out with a lot, all right? But you can cut this in half. I always start with a pound. But
okay.
If you start out with something like a pound of ground chuck,
okay,
you would have maybe a cup of grated cheese that really tastes good. Maybe it would be something like Parmigiano.
Okay.
Or a mixture of a Parmigiano and maybe something like a really tasty sheep's cheese, okay? Oh. And you could have that even shredded so you get bits of it, you see? And you would have maybe a half a cup of fresh breadcrumbs.
Okay.
And I like to soak those breadcrumbs in red wine.
Really?
Yeah, like a third of a cup of red wine, you know? Just get them moistened. And I mix that all together, and then I throw in maybe a tablespoon of tomato paste, fresh basil, fresh parsley. I mince up garlic with that. There's chopped browned onion in there. Now, I'm going on and on here, but uh-huh. there are recipes out there.
Right.
And the most dependable recipes that you're generally going to find are going to be recipes like on Epicurious, because recipes coming out of like Bon Appetit, the old gourmet magazine, because they tested them.
Right.
But the idea is that you want to make a meatball that has a tremendous amount of flavor in it. You want an egg yolk in there because that's going to help bind it together.
Oh, okay.
All right. Oh. The cheese will help bind it together.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to mix that all up, and then you're going to chill it, all right? And then you're going to make small balls. You want the balls to be maybe an inch and a half in diameter, unless he likes them bigger.
Right, okay? Right.
And then what you want to do is you want to put, I like to put them in the oven.
Okay, I was wondering about that.
Well, some people like to brown them in a pan, but these are fragile.
Okay.
These are not solid, hard meatballs. They are a little on the fragile side.
Yeah.
So I put them in the oven. I space them in a shallow baking pan.
Okay.
All right. And what I do is I roast them in the oven until they're brown. So I put them in at about 450. Okay. And I just want to brown them. And I use a pancake turner.
Oh.
You know, a metal spatula, because I can get underneath them and gently turn them over.
Yes. I want to be very careful with
these. Yes. I just want to brown them. I pull them out of the oven. Okay. They're not cooked all the way through.
Uh-huh.
And then I make a very simple tomato sauce.
Okay.
You take a big skillet.
Okay.
Okay, a sauté pan or a skillet. Sauté pan, straight-sided. Skillet has slant sides. I like the straight-sided because I can get more in it.
Okay.
You're going to take a nice big onion, chop it up, film the bottom of the pan with olive oil.
All right.
Add the onion, a little salt and pepper, and you're going to sauté that until the onion is golden brown.
Okay.
You're going to throw in two or three minced up cloves of garlic, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste.
Okay.
All right? And you're going to sauté that for a few moments until you can smell it.
Mm.
Don't overdo it. You don't want to brown the garlic. Okay.
Okay.
Add about a third a cup of wine. Boil that down to absolutely nothing.
All right.
All right? Now add 1 can of whole tomatoes.
Whole tomatoes.
By the way, I like Muir Glen because
okay.
I like organic and I like the taste of their tomatoes. You want a big can.
Okay.
And 1 small can. This is for a pound of pasta.
All right.
And you're going to just stir that in and you're going and break them up as they go in the pan so they're chunky.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're going to then let that simmer, stirring it until it thickens. Just 5 to 8 minutes. Now you're going to put your meatballs in there.
Okay, I was wondering about that.
Now you're going to simmer your meatballs in that. You're going to turn them gently. You're going to cook them very gently until you put an instant reading thermometer in the meatball and it reads about 160
degrees.
160
degrees.
Okay. And then you're done. And you do that the day before he lands, because then the meatballs absorb all that great flavor. You gently reheat them in it, and then you just lift the meatballs out of the sauce, toss the pasta with the sauce, and put the hot meatballs on the top.
This is fantastic.
Okay.
I'm so honored to have you help me with this.
Hey, this is a big deal. This is the beginning of a new life for you, too.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. Oh,
hey, this is going to work.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can call us 800-537-5252. You can follow us on Twitter, friend us on Facebook, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Tony's on the line from Valley City, North Dakota. Tony?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What do you want to talk about?
Well, my wife and I are big fans of Korean food, and living in small-town North Dakota, we don't have many options for restaurants, so I was really hoping you could recommend a Korean cookbook for me.
You know, I think if you check out our site, there's a couple of books that you're going to find there. One is The Korean Table, and it's by Tae Kwin Chan and Deborah Samuels, and the other one is Eating Korean, and it's by Cecilia Hae-jin Lee. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to think other good sources. You know where I would go to get really opinionated, because that's what you want?
Right, and passionate.
And passionate about the subject. Mm-hmm. I would take a look at Chowhound.
Okay.
You know, take a look at their chats. And the other thing is take a look at anything that David Chang has talked about.
All right.
And take a look at eGullet. Again, opinion. Okay. These are sites where you're going to find opinions, people who have tried recipes, et cetera. And take a look at our site. And I think you might have some good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Take
Bye
care.
Now.
Claire is calling from Austin, Texas. Claire, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I have started making sweet potato oven fries for dinner as a side dish.
Right.
And initially, I started making them because I thought my 9-year-old son would love them and eat them with ketchup. And the way it worked out is that he doesn't like them, but I do. And so I'm looking for other things to eat them with besides ketchup. Some kind of sauce, or in possibly other ideas about seasoning, because I've just been using salt and pepper. So do you have any ideas?
Oh, dear. Let me count the ways. No, because this is the thing. Because they're sweet and they're so rich tasting, they can take almost any kind of seasoning. So I'll give you an instance, okay? We can go the Moroccan route. You toss them with a little olive oil, with the salt and pepper, and then you add cinnamon, coriander, cumin, and even a little garlic. You toss that and you make your oven fries. Then what you can do is you can now I'm not sure if the youngin is going to want this, but you're going to love it.
Who can forget him?
We'll forget him for the moment.
These are for me.
Okay. So then this is what you would do. You could make essentially what's called a tremula, and it's a sauce or a marinade because it's used in a lot of ways, where you would put in a food processor olive oil, fresh lemon juice, garlic, fresh coriander, and in this case, fresh mint and a little honey. So you have a sweet sort of tart take. And if you want something hot and spicy like fresh chili, and you'd puree that together and you get a thick sauce out of that. You roll those babies around in that and you are going to be in heaven. I mean, or just dip into it and stick it in the fridge because you can marinate stuff in that. You could, you know, thin it down and use it as a salad dressing. But that with those fries, that would be just fabulous.
That does sound yummy.
Yeah. And, you know, then you could go with the fries. You could go with the fresh ginger with the garlic and the chili route. You toss it, you know, with some oil. So that'll help it stick to the fries. And you eat that with fresh lime juice on it when it comes out of the oven. That's sort of an Asian take. And then you could go to Italy and you could do lemon zest and fresh rosemary and fine chopped onion and olive oil. And you're down another path.
That sounds good, too.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? I mean, we could sort of travel the world with those oven fries. And somewhere along the line, your child may actually be curious enough to give it a shot.
That's what I hope for, but I'm not going to wait around on him.
I don't think you want to hold your breath, but try these. See what you think.
I will. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252 or follow us on Twitter, check us out on Facebook, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Emma Piper Burkett is a young American food activist who in 2009 found herself in Iraq
in the midst of the war, trying to help a broken farm system. She'd heard Iraq's seed bank was destroyed, programs to help farmers, like Oil for Food, weren't working, and she got an idea. The Iraqi Seed Project. We talked to Emma in 2010 when it was in its infancy, and now I'd like to check in and see what's happened since then. Emma, welcome back. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me back.
Well, we talked in 2010, but could you recap for us how you got this idea in the first place and what you did?
Yes. So in April of 2009, I made my first trip to Iraq. I was working on an online cooking show called Kitchen Caravan that I started with a friend, and we were in the Middle East doing some episodes about food production in the region, and I found myself in Iraq recording some local recipes, and I started just learning more and more about the farming system there and how it was the birthplace of wheat. 10,000 years ago, that's where it was first cultivated, and now they were importing it from the U.S. and Australia. And just little pieces of information like that struck me as very important to let people know about, that that was what was happening. So, but
I mean, there was a war going on in 2009.
Yes, I went to the northern area. I went by myself. The northern area, there wasn't really violence in that same way after the 2003 invasion, so I actually felt really safe.
I see. So now, what did you actually do then?
So after that, I started just reading more, trying to learn about the history, trying to learn about what was happening then, talking to people that were working in different aid ways, and just trying to document in small ways. I made 3 trips, and I would just record a little bit every time, talking to farmers, talking to government officials, just trying to figure out what was going on in farming, because even though it's a really important part of the Iraqi economy, there's not a lot of information about what is actually happening on the ground. So I had to do a lot of that for myself, and I'm still working on that part. So
what did you actually discover? I mean, in the midst of a war, could Iraq feed itself?
Well, I think that, as you mentioned, the Oil for Food program and just the wars that have been happening in the area since the 1980s, the agricultural sector has pretty much been at a bit of a standstill for the past 30 years. So now, as we hear a lot about the reconstruction, you know, agriculture is obviously a big part of that. But it's almost like, in a lot of ways, it feels like they're starting from scratch, which is really strange when you think about the history that they're coming from.
Yeah, because this was like the cradle of civilization. This
right.
was an area. This is an area where many of the legumes that we all eat originally came from, and wheat came from,
chickpeas,
and grapes,
lentils.
Yeah.
So there's the documentation part of it, and then there's also trying to create this platform for exchange, and I think that that will probably take a lot of different forms. We are about to launch a web documentary called "This Is Fertile Ground," and that will be out in the next couple of weeks, and it will be in English and Arabic and Kurdish, and just to try to get people to be able to actually see what is happening with farming in Iraq right now.
What's that going to look like?
It's going to be a series of videos, very short videos that will not play in any particular order. It's just kind of trying to give people an overview in many different areas. As people watch these videos, we have some animations of native Iraqi crops, and they will start sprouting and growing. So the idea is that by learning and watching, we're kind of revitalizing the farming. I mean, it's a symbolic thing, but it's just, you know, one small step.
So what will it feel like to you if things don't change?
I think that would be sad. I think we have a lot to learn from the farmers there, and I think, you know, right now, as I said, it feels like they're starting from scratch, so they're very, you know, ready to adopt new technology and new techniques, but I guess there's a part of me that feels anxious that I don't want them to lose the traditions that they have just in the haste to kind of get started again. So,
yeah. This is not something, as you said, that's unique to Iraq, is it?
No, I mean, I think it's a phenomenon that's happening everywhere. And, you know, on this last trip, I got really determined. I was like, I'm going to find, like, young people that are interested in farming. And I was there for 3 weeks, and we could not find one. And that, to me, was sad. I mean, and that's something that I think is obviously very reflective of everything that's happening in the rest of the world, too. It's mm-hmm. like young people, they want to live in the cities, they want fancy cars, and they don't want to be part of that agrarian lifestyle. I mean, and the thing is that I feel like in this country here, we're starting to see that change a little bit. Like, farming is actually getting to be kind of cool, which if I can share that, like the coolness of farming in this country, if I can share that with the Iraqi youth, I'll feel like I was successful.
Well, we wish you very good luck. Very good luck. Emma, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Food activist Emma Piper Burkett has created the Iraqi Seed Project. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Stay in touch. Thanks for listening. And until next time, let me leave you with this old German proverb. To bury grief, plant a seed. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcasts, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our archives of our key three interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every cook should know. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.